Hi there, this is Andrew from the Average Guy Podcast Network. The Average Guy Podcasts are brought to you uninterrupted and commercial free. If you'd like to help us keep it that way, please visit the donate/deals page over at The Average Guy TV and visit one of our sponsors.
This is the Home Tech Podcast Show number 39, recorded on August 11th, 2010. I am your host, Jim Collison, broadcasting live on live stream from the Average Guy Studios here in a very sunny and very pleasant. God, we've had some hot weather as of late, and today it was just a beautiful 80-degree, no-humidity day in Bellevue, Nebraska, and posted each week at theaverageguy.tv. You can contact the show. Just send me an email, podcast@theaverageguy.tv. Follow me on the show or follow all the tweets that we do for the show on Twitter. That is just at Jay Collison, and you can find us on Facebook. And we've been trying to push some of the traffic out to Facebook from a forum standpoint. Just search The Average Guy Podcast on Facebook, and you'll find us. We've been getting a couple viewers out there to join each week and build in that group. Great place to put show notes. I don't really want to build forums yet for this podcast, and so we're going to kind of just try and piggyback on Facebook. Welcome to the show tonight. I'm missing Christian and Andrew, hoping Andrew will join us shortly. Hopefully last week he got a chance to listen to Gary and I talk about his setup with Subsonic. And I want to remind folks that we've also got a couple other podcasts out there, Financial Tech Podcast and the Fitness Tech Podcast, although I have been taking a little bit of a hiatus from the Fitness Tech Podcast just because I lost my other host. So it's kind of a bummer when you got a podcast alone, and I just won't do that. So but if you want to pop out there, we also started a new podcast 2 weeks ago called Rich's Random Podcast Generator. And we do that on the weekends. We get together on Sunday afternoons, open up Google Plus, and the first 10 tech guys to jump in get to just guide the conversation. And we record for about an hour and a half to 2 hours, and just whatever comes out, comes out. So join us over there. All those podcasts available over at theaverageguy.tv. All right, with Christian and Andrew out tonight, I do have two other hosts joining me. First is my good friend Gordon Schmidt. Gordon's been on the show before and is a good friend of the homeservershow.com and all things IOSafe, because I see you got that IOSafe on the shelf right behind you. Gordon, how are you doing?
I do. Good. Glad to be here.
Yeah, what size is that IOSafe that you have up there?
1.5 terabyte.
That's nice.
It is very
nice. How much did you pay for that?
Let's see. I didn't pay anything.
Really?
Yeah.
Did you win that somewhere?
I did. I won it at the homeservershow.com 100th show giveaway.
How full is it now?
It is a little over 500 gigs is all.
Oh, okay. So you got some more space. Fireproof, waterproof, IOSafe solo, right?
Yep.
Yeah, it's a good little box. I've got one right down on the on the basement floor over there. Well, not, it's up on a shelf, but I think I have the 1 terabyte, and I'm getting closer to filling that thing up a little more often. Are you on the upper floor there? So would it would be fire damage you'd be worried about with that?
Yep, I am up on the upper floor. So
yeah, and then what's next to it? What do you got?
Mediasonic 4-bay enclosure.
Oh, nice.
And what do you got? Connected to the Optiplex, right above it, sitting on top of my shelf.
And
so I use that. That's got a single hard drive in it for the operating system.
So that your home server. That's your home server storage on there. And so there's 4 drives. Are they rated in some way?
I have the first 2 with a software RAID on it, with like photos, homemade videos and stuff on it, and then the rest is just sporadic throughout it.
All right. That's nice. It's got a good camera view there. We can see your IOSave. We can see your home server. Way to pimp it, Gordon. Nice job. Oh, and then what's up there? What do you?
This would be the Galaxy Tab.
Oh, nice.
Box. So.
Yeah, and you actually have one of those?
I do. I picked one up.
How long have you had it?
2.5 weeks.
Okay. Well, we're going to talk about the HP touchpad because I picked one of those up on Monday. We'll talk about that here shortly. But I do want to introduce John Hughes. John is a software developer and develops around home automation. John, you haven't been on the podcast before, so one, we want to welcome you. And then I thought maybe you could spend just a few minutes giving us a little bit of your technical background and what you do.
Sure. I first want to thank you for having me on the show. I'm excited to be here.
Yeah, good to have you.
And as you mentioned before, I've worked with Gordon on a few projects before in the past, so that's how I got the link in here to be here today, and I appreciate that. A little bit of background on my technical past is I started as a Amiga
OS way back. Developer. Yeah, okay.
Well, I shouldn't say what I started
year?
As that.
But what year would that have been?
Oh, wow. I don't know. It's a long time ago.
Okay.
85, maybe?
Okay, 85, 86, 87, somewhere in
probably.
There.
Probably.
Yeah. Yeah.
Before that, it was the Commodore 64, VIC-20, and the MC-10 from Radio Shack.
Wow.
That goes basic, ahead. Yeah. That's really where I got my start. But I was a big Amiga OS person. If you search for my name out there, you'll find a couple open source projects that I did long, long time ago. In fact, I went online just a while back just to see where things were at, because Amigas, they've been pretty much gone for a long time, but there's been a cult following.
Sure.
And I actually found that someone had written a little article about one of the products I had produced for the Amiga, a little open source thing. And just like within the last couple of years, I thought it was hilarious. But that's great to see people still are involved with projects. And from then, I ended up moving into the Microsoft domain, which I tried to avoid as much as possible before college. And then got a master's degree in computer science. I have a background in film as well. I have a bachelor's degree in film. So nice. That's what I really wanted to get into. But yeah, so I ended up in the Microsoft domain, and I've been a technical architect and work with a small company, and we do a little bit of everything. So C# is a big thing for us, and a lot of architecture. And as Gordon, I don't know, would you say our application, Gordon, is an enterprise application, I guess?
Yeah, definitely an enterprise application, yeah.
One of the projects that I work on. So. But the home automation stuff just started a few years ago, and as more of a hobby, and I got more and more interested in it. I bought a couple products, and they didn't work as well as I wanted, or they didn't do what I needed them to do. So I started out as more of a, I want this specific role, and I couldn't get that, so I developed. And then it ended up growing and growing, and people started using it. And
Very cool.
So that's the short version.
Yeah. Yeah. And so we're going to talk a little bit about that in depth here in a little bit. So hold on to that a little bit. The most important question we have to ask you, though, before you start the show is what is your phone?
Oh, really? that's complicated.
Hey, go ahead, John. You're Microsoft, part of the Microsoft domain. Go ahead.
Uh-oh.
No, I have an iPhone. I have an iPhone.
Okay, and, that's all right.
I have an iPhone guy. I think that Android is the speeding bullet right now, and it's really coming up, and I think that they have made a lot of great progress. Honestly, I would love to see Microsoft do a little bit more, but Android is really, really coming up, and I think with some of the 3.0 features, I think they're going to probably do pretty well. I'm interested to see what iPhone has coming out too, but I think with the last release that they had, things just seem to be slowing down a little bit.
That's interesting. Have you looked at the Windows Phone at all? And is that enticing to you at all from a platform?
It's such a different paradigm, right? It's so different. And then I've seen the Windows 8 demos, which kind of parallel that in many ways. And it's so different. And I know that's what they want to do is be different, but at the same time, you've got to sell products. So I'm not sure how that's going to work out.
Yeah.
They're actually putting an update to the Xbox as well to use the same tile effect.
Oh, okay. When is that? So, okay, this fall. My Xbox just burned out. So
nice.
I got the Red Ring of Death. I had two Xbox classics that have gone bad in the last 2 years.
Have you tried any of the little tweaks and stuff, wrapping it in a towel and letting it run to resolder anything?
I'm going
to
try a sledgehammer to it, and I'm going to go buy a mini, or I'm going to go buy a Slim. That's the
nice. That's what I have.
You know, at 100, we bought the original Xbox when it first came out. There's Andrew. Good. Let's see if I can bring him in. Okay. One sec, guys. I will finish that story here in one sec. Let's see if we can bring Andrew into the conference, because I do want to have him on the podcast tonight. We'll say hi to Andrew. Andrew, you out there?
Yeah, I'm out here.
All right.
I haven't even got anything plugged in.
Okay. Well, mute it as you plug it in, and I'll watch for your video, and I'll bring you in the show here in just a sec. While I'll finish my Xbox story, and then that'll give you time to get set up. So I remember when Xbox first came out, and the kids had to have it. This is Xbox 360. Kids had to have it. I made them save like $300. And I think those things were $4.99 or something like that. I mean, they were ridiculous when they first came out. And so, of course, we bought them. They'd only been out maybe 2 or 3 months when we first bought ours. And that first one red ringed. And so I bought, of course, we did one or two warranty services on that one. And then I bought a second one on eBay about 2 or 3 years after that for $199. It was a refurb. That's the one I still have. And it red ringed the other night, and I really just don't want to smash it. Take it out in the sludge.
Glad of love for it
and call it good. Yeah, I mean it, you know, Xbox. Have you, John? Are you? You got any game consoles at your place?
I have a PlayStation 3 that I break out about twice a year
for the Blu-ray or just to play.
Oh, that's a good point. So right, I get a little more Blu-ray use out of it to play, okay. But I unfortunately don't have a lot of free time, so. I don't get to play it as much as I'd like.
Yeah. Mine died, and so we'll be buying that. Well, John, here in a few minutes, we'll talk about home automation. So I appreciate you coming on the show, and you'd mentioned Android. I am an Android guy as well, moving over from the Palm OS that I had. I jumped off of Winmo 6.5 onto Palm about a year ago, about 2 years ago now, and then made the jump from Palm to Android. And I went to Android because Palm was not moving fast enough. Right. Of course, HP picked up that purchase for a cool, I don't know. Andrew, are you there with us yet? How much did HP buy Palm for? You remember $6 billion or something like that? He's not with us yet. So anyway, over the last, July 1st in the United States, the HP released the touchpad, and I've been trying to get my hands on one. They have been difficult to get a hold of, but I was able to get one through a friend here in the Omaha area at Forsyth, and he has let me borrow that touchpad for a month, and I've been evaluating it. If you want to check out, I'm not going to bore you with all the comments here, but I've been writing daily blog posts about the experience. TheAverageGuy.tv, just take a peek at those. One of the features that I discovered in it today, or I think maybe yesterday, was it's got Skype integration built into it, which I was looking for a Skype app and I couldn't find one. And I'm like, oh, crap, this thing sucks if it doesn't have Skype. Are you kidding me? This won't work for me. And by mistake, I got a message from Rich O'Neill, one of the guys I was talking with. I thought, oh, well, maybe that was Google Chat. And then I realized, wait a minute, I don't have Rich on Google Chat. And I looked, and Skype had signed itself in. I must have put my password in there at some point, sometime doing something. And I said, well, maybe it's just I am. And so I looked carefully, and no, there was a call button, right? So I hit the call button, and it started ringing. I was like, hey. And not only would it call, but it would video chat. And I just did a video conference with Mike Howard, a guy who guest hosts on the show about every 8 weeks. And pretty good video of him. My video wasn't great. We were getting a little bit of echo from the speaker microphone combination. But I was able to hold a pretty good conversation on that. Gordon, you've got the Galaxy Tab there. Is that integrated in? Is Skype integrated in on
It isn't integrated. I had to go find the Skype app and download it and things. But it does work good.
Does work well. Yeah, that was a surprise to me. I was Andrew and I had been doing some testing off our phones, doing some Skype across 3G and trying to see how that would work. We didn't have the greatest success. Andrew, are you there yet?
Yeah, I'm here, Jim.
All right. How you doing? Good to see you, man.
Oh, it's been a while.
Crazy day, huh?
Do you like the suntan?
you traveled north for vacation, right? I mean,
yeah, we did. We head up to Queensland last week for a week in the sun.
Nice. Andrew, meet John Hughes. He's one of the guys. Hopefully, you can see his video. John, this is
hey, John. How are
you? Hi, Andrew. It's good to meet you.
Vacation. You're back at work. I'm sure HP is glad to have you back.
Oh yeah, HP is taking advantage of me having had a week off.
Of course they always do, right? No That's good it. Vacation goes unpunished.
Too true.
Right? So, so the touchpad experiment has been going well. I know, Andrew, that you sent me a note of encouragement when I told you I had a touchpad in my hand.
Absolutely.
Not a bad little device. It lacks apps, and I've got a couple posts coming out about the lack of applications on that. Gordon, on the Galaxy Tab, of course, you've got access to I don't know how many Android apps are out there now.
I don't know, hundreds of thousands.
yeah. But
it's pretty ridiculous. There's a lot of bad ones out there that aren't necessarily worth anything, but There are plenty of good ones out there.
Well, and to be honest, there's a lot of bad apps in the WebOS catalog as well. As I was looking through those, I was reminded it had been a couple months since I had been on my Pre, and I have kept my Pre as a kind of a music player in the car. I load it up with some music, just plug it in like an MP3. It works, an MP3 player, iPod, whatever, works just great. But I was reminded of how many bad apps are out there and how few are getting developed. So I won't steal the thunder of some additional blog posts that are coming out, but we're going to talk a little bit about apps coming up. I think if you're looking for a tablet and you don't want to go into the Apple ecosystem and you're not interested in Android, I think the WebOS, at least at this point, I'm 4 days into it, the WebOS offers a nice tablet alternative. And I think they're dropping the price at the same rate the U.S. stock market is dropping. They just look at – they're like, oh, the Dow is at 10,000. Okay, take another $100 off. And
it's interesting. It hasn't been released to the market yet out here in Australia, and it's already dropped $100 on retail.
Yeah. So is it $4.99 for you guys as well?
$4.99? It is.
I think so.
I think it's dropped from $5.29 to $4.29 or something like that.
Okay, yeah. John, if you had a choice of a tablet right now, do you got your eye on anything, or is a tablet kind of whatever?
I'm afraid of the tablets because I feel like I can buy a laptop for the same price and get a lot more out of it. But I think that what HP is doing is great. I have been a fan of Palm ever since it was US Robotics. Followed them since then, and I really like their operating system. I like the way it works, and I think that if they can get some apps out there, I think it could do quite well.
Yeah, I don't disagree with you. I'd love to see, and I know Palm tried to do this. Of course, they had limited cash when they first released this, and there's unlimited cash now at HP, I'm sure. I think they're going to have to pay, to be honest, to get some of the best apps out there. I've been comparing some of the apps. The next post, I think, maybe this weekend, is to look at all the apps that I currently use on my Android device and what's missing from the Palm ecosystem. I'm sorry, from the HP ecosystem. It's really hard for me to get used to saying HP instead of Palm. Not like I said, not a bad little device. I want to give it another week or two. I do think, John, it could be a laptop replacer. One of my conditions of using a pad full time was that I'd have to be able to write a blog off of it. It would have to have some kind of blog writing editing software. And there is, this just surprised me, there is a really good WordPress app that allows you to manage your WordPress sites, multiple sites, as well as the comments, posts, stats, and there's one other one. What would I be missing? Comments, posts, stats, and there's one other. As well as a fairly decent, it's pretty basic, but a fairly decent editor. And with a little Bluetooth keyboard that I have that's not quite as responsive as I'd like it to be. I can type faster than it can keep up sometimes. But that's what I need a laptop for. So now you're a developer, you probably aren't going to think about using a tablet device to compile code, right?
No, you would probably never want to do that. Yeah. But you could. Now that doesn't mean that there's a lot of Linux guys out there that are probably trying to do that on a variety of different tablets. I think tablets have a great space in the, we'll talk about it later, but in the home automation market, they have a great space for that, especially as prices are coming down. But for me, as someone who wants to take something on an airplane, for example, or out just for entertainment, if you're going to watch movies or something, or just browse the internet, I think they're a great tool for that. But I think the price is still a little too high to attract me for that purpose.
Yeah. Well, the touchpad, we just alluded to it, $100 off. So $499 to $399. This last weekend here in the United States, Staples and a few other places were also offering another $100. So $299 for the 16 gig version.
Oh, wow.
That is nearly a trigger pulling incident for me.
That is. That sounds really, really appetizing. That's
cool. Yeah,
just got to pass it by your CFO then, right?
Well, yeah, and the Collison budget is still trying to pay for a May 4th wedding that nearly broke us. So it's, but I wasn't as serious about a tablet until I got my hands on this one, and certainly an iPad has more apps to it, and I do want to take a hard look at the app ecosystem. It does most of what I need it to do. The email, the unified email functionality and unified messaging functionality on the webOS is second to none. There is nobody, in my opinion, my humble opinion, there is nobody doing email unification better than the webOS. And it literally, you just bring your accounts in and you can see them all in one, or you can click down and get maybe just one inbox at a time, or you can break it down and get all your folders in your email, both Exchange and Pop and Gmail. And it's just dynamite. Andrew, have you had in your experience, have you seen that application or the web or the email unification in anything you've done?
No. The only visibility we've had of the device so far is they had a bit of a demo stand in the cafeteria a couple of weeks ago. Okay. When they first announced it was coming to Australia. So they had, I think, one Gmail account set up on it. And look, it seemed to work pretty well.
Yeah.
I think you sort of hit the nail on the head with the ecosystem. I think one thing that we're seeing at the moment is it's going to be very much similar to the way Apple control iOS on the iPad. So I think I know there's some homebrew type arrangements going on out there on the market, but I think for the most part, I think the operating system will be fairly well controlled. Whereas I think if you look at, say, an Android tablet, the problem with Android is this: they've still got that big fragmentation issue, where you can pick up an Asus EE transformer and it does one thing, and you pick up the Samsung Galaxy Tab and it does something different, and the Motorola Zoom's different again.
Well, and we even know by the different placement of the buttons on phones that the standardization, exactly, right, is poor on the Android side. Gordon, talk a little bit about what's the game changer. Have you found a game changer on your Galaxy Tab? Is there something in there you say, oh, this is worth, this was worth the cost?
So I just went on a business trip out to New York, and I had to bring my work laptop, but the tablet for personal use was perfect. It did everything I wanted it to do: email, I could watch Netflix on it, browse the web, play games, a variety of stuff, and it's thin, light, and doesn't require a lot of management. It's, other than the new TouchWiz UI that Samsung just pushed out to it or made available to it and kind of made it not look as nice on the screen. But other than that, I'm very happy with it.
What do you guys think about the Barnes & Noble Nook category?
And so, John, referencing Barnes & Noble Nook running Android?
Yes, as an alternative tablet-like operating system, because they're starting to release applications for it. It's got a browser. I think you can watch a video on it as well.
I think it's missing the specs. It's missing the specs and performance that you're going to get out of something like the Samsung Tab, or even the, I'm not sure what the HP touchpad has, but I know the Nook, the reviews I've heard from other people that have like a Nook Color and stuff that are running Android is that it seems to be underpowered.
Yeah, I used it a few weeks ago, and it was a little slow.
Yeah, I think the Nook, where it was originally targeted as an e-book reader, is probably a little bit underdone. I know one of the aftermarket ROM kitchens released a full Android ROM for it the other day, and Brian Burgess had an article on how to root it and install a different ROM onto it in Byte. I think that came through this morning, my time.
Yeah, I heard about that.
It's an interesting we are an interesting time when it comes to tablets, and I think we're still kind of in the early stages of maturity of these, although it does seem like it's shaking out. I think at one point I thought Android was never going to get a tablet to market that had any viability on it, and I think we're going to see a couple hit it. I think the webOS is strong. Of course, the iPad just dominates everything at this point. And Andrew, let me ask you, choice where money's no option and you don't have to be politically correct, what kind of tablet are you going to go with?
Wow. I'm curious. I want to have a look at the Galaxy Tab, although with the latest Apple court case, it's not going to reach Australia, it appears.
Okay. All right. That's too bad.
So, yeah. After the play I had with WebOS, I like it, but I'd like to see a rear-facing camera. So for me, if I'm going to be carrying around a tablet that's got a camera that looks at me in the face,
true.
I also want to be able to take a photo at what I'm actually looking at.
True. Good point.
Which is I think where Apple have it. I don't have a use for a tablet at the moment.
Okay.
Fair enough. It's a hard one for me, but that to me is. Those to me are the criteria. I want to be able to take a photo with it if I've got it out and about, but I also want it to not be in a fragmented operating system.
Okay. And just to add there, when I was looking at purchasing a tablet, I was looking at the iPad 2 and the Samsung Galaxy Tab. But one thing I love on my Samsung Galaxy S phone versus an iPhone is the fact that there's widgets on it. I can press one button to turn it on, enter a pin, or just swipe the screen, and I've got live information right there without having to go into an application, wait for that to update. And the same thing goes with the tab. I can just turn it on, go through the security, or unlock it, and I've got information right there.
So are you sold on the Android? If money wasn't an option, you could make the purchase over again, would you do something different?
No, I'd still get the Samsung Tab.
Okay, John, what about you? If money's no option and you can buy anything you want, do you stick in your Apple ecosystem or you try something different?
I honestly don't have an Apple ecosystem, but I have the iPhone.
Right.
But as I mentioned, I'm a Microsoft guy, so I kind of try to cross collaborate. But I would go with the iPad too. Although I do really like what Gordon's talking about it. Being able to just turn it on and see what's going on, what's happening.
Yeah. You know, there's been some talk of HP adding, not talk, I think they're going to do this. They're going to add the WebOS to the front of their laptop line. And so you boot up, when you boot up a laptop, you get the option to boot into the WebOS first thing. And the WebOS does boot very, very quickly. And so, you know, you'd have some capabilities of doing some things very fast. I think it's a great move. I'd love to be able to put the WebOS on the front end of my HP DM1Z that I got from them. That would make that a really nice little laptop. The problem is it's not touchscreen, so some of those features that you would use, you'd need to use the keyboard for. But if you to get quick access to some of those devices, it may not be bad. So we'll have to see. Okay, go ahead, Gordon. Sorry.
I'm sorry. Is it HP that did that on their laptops where you could watch, you didn't have to boot the laptop up, you could watch a DVD or browse the web or something without even booting it up?
Splash top,
is that what that's called? Yeah. And so I get the option every time I boot my laptop, that comes up first, and if I don't say I want it, it goes away and boots into Windows.
Quick Web on mine, HP Quick Web.
Quick Web?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, HP's name for its Quick Web. If you don't have an HP device, you can download it from splashtop.com.
Okay.
It'll run on like a Dell.
Gotcha. Okay.
A Dell or whatever, but predominantly it's for the HP platform.
John, do you use that Quick Boot at all on your laptop?
Pretty much never, and I'll tell you why. And this may be a user problem more than an actual device problem, but it seems to me, and I have not seen how to toggle back and forth between it without actually going into the Windows OS and choosing that the next time I reboot, I want to go into the HP Quick Web. There's no button on the machine that I can find that would boot into that or any other quick way for me as I'm turning on the machine, which OS do I want to go into?
Yeah. Good point. Good point. Hey, John, do me a favor. See if there's anything downloading off your PC or uploading. Your video quality got really bad all of a sudden. We'll see if just double check as we hit it. I want to hear you real well as we go into this home automation segment. There we go. Gordon, while John's looking at that, real quick, this week you tweeted out, I think, or maybe on Google Plus, that you'd bought a brand new Ford. And my first reaction was, congratulations. How do you like your sink? How do you like the sink, Gordon?
I don't like it very much. I ended up opting not to get it. Yeah. It does offer So the concept in itself is super cool. Definitely something I want. But when we were test driving them around, having the kids in there, testing space and things out with the car seats, the guy was actually trying to use it, and the kids were actually being loud enough where he couldn't actually make a command. He kept having to try and try with it, and it wasn't picking anything up. It wasn't until everybody was quiet in the vehicle that it would actually respond to him and play like genre rock or play, you know, White Knight song or, you know, whatever he was trying to do.
Right. So for it was purely, in your case, purely an individual decision because you're thinking, hey, I got a bunch of kids. They're going to make a bunch of noise every time they're in the car. It's going to be hard for me to operate sync. Is that pretty much what you're thinking?
Yeah, and so the vehicle's not going to last us long enough. I mean, our oldest is 4, so by the time he's old enough to actually enjoy it and be quiet somewhat in the vehicle, we'll be on to something else. So maybe in the next one.
It's way too much thinking, Gordon. You should have just bought it with sync. That's way too much thinking. Well, you had a chance. I was kind of pumped because I wanted to hear, you know, I knew you were going to be on the podcast. So I was like, hey, Gordon can talk about a sync. I know Chris Lux has used sync in the past and has really liked it. And so I thought maybe that would be some geeky thing that you do.
Not yet.
All right. Well, we'll try that again. Andrew, is Ford sync an option, you know, in Australia there? Can you get, is that available there?
I think the very latest, is it the Focus or Fiesta or something comes with it, but I'm a Subaru. We're a Subaru family, so you know that car with an oval badge on it. I don't know.
Andrew, your bandwidth is outstanding. I just want to tell you that you are crisp and clear, and it's like you're just here.
Yeah, cool.
I don't know what you're doing, but you're doing
must
right.
Must be because I've got everything else turned off in the house today. Maybe
there you go. Well, we brought John Hughes on because we wanted to talk about home automation. And John, you opened the show talking a little bit about what you do and some stuff around. You've kind of recently have written some stuff using home automation just because you didn't find anything that's out there. My wife asked me before yesterday. She actually listens to the show, which is kind of crazy. She said, hey, so what are you guys talking about? And I said, I got Gordon and this guy, John Hughes. And she first said, who's John Hughes? And I said, he's a guy who does software. And like, she's going to know. And then she said, I'm just going to get in trouble for just saying that. But then I said, we're going to talk about home automation. And she went, home automation, what's that? You know, and so I think my impression for the average guy is that there's still kind of this weird question mark that pops up in people's minds when they think about home automation, and maybe they think about the robot from the Jetsons that would right that would do the vacuuming and that kind of stuff with the maid outfit on. But John, tell us a little bit about where is the world of home automation today as you see it, and maybe as we talked about the tablets, and you can bring those in because I do think there's a huge application for that as well with home automation. But what's the state of home automation today as you see it?
Well, I think there's you can probably divide it up into quite a few categories, but if I was to generalize, I'd probably divide it up into about maybe 3 just off the top of my head. And that would be for a user or a person who knows exactly what they want and they want to do everything and they're going to go with a full on system, hire a professional integrator and really deck out their home or their office. And then there's other people who want to get into it a little bit and they know they want to maybe be able to control or automate some lights in the house, which I think is a way a lot of people get into it, that maybe the thermostats. And then there's the people who are more like your wife, and because it's such a niche product, it doesn't get a lot of headlines and people don't know what it is. The average person doesn't use it, or if they do use it, they don't know they're using it. And the interesting thing is there is, you guys talk about the tablets and then the difference between all the different Android tablets out there. And that's pretty much where the state of home automation is. There's standardizations, but there's more than one. So if that makes any sense, and everybody wants their standard to be the one, there's a variety of different technologies, and they're all competing. And to be honest with you, it depends on what your needs are, and we can go into that more later. And it depends on, a lot of it depends on if how your house is set up and how what you're actually able to do.
Now, tell us a little bit about, so if you're the home automation guy and you're writing software, right, and we're all geeks and we tend to overdo in our own houses that which we're most passionate about. Is your house automated to the hilt? I mean, do you got every bell and whistle that you could do from that standpoint? Your fridge is keeping track of the food that comes in and out of it, and the lights come on and off magically.
Right.
What's your setup like?
You actually hit on a point that I was going to bring up later, and that is just because you can automate something doesn't necessarily mean you should. For example, the refrigerators that keep track of the food that comes in and out and keeps your grocery list, I think that's great for some people, but for my personal needs, I don't think it makes a whole lot of sense for my family. For anyone who buys the same groceries every week, maybe that works out. But the system you're describing is in a variety of different products, and that is one of their check boxes to say, hey, we support the refrigerator that keeps track of your groceries. So that's a great one. But no, my house is probably not as decked out as a Microsoft dream home might be. But I do control all the lights in the house. Are controlled by automation. The alarm system is integrated. The irrigation system outside, we have a three-zone irrigation system, is automated. All the thermostats are – well, that's not technically true. All the thermostats were automated until recently. The home theater system is automated. Another good point to bring up here is the difference between automation and control. Because a lot of what I'm describing is more control than automation.
All right. So talk about the difference between those two words then.
Okay. So the way I would put it or describe it is automation is when an event occurs, you want to trigger something else. You want some other action to occur. So, for example, your alarm is set and you come home. As soon as the door opens and the alarm is set, you want to turn the lights on in the entryway that you just came home. That's automation. So some event occurred, and you want that to trigger another event or another action so that you don't have to flip the light switch. That's more automation. Control comes in, and is tightly coupled with automation, in that control is being able to use, for example, a tablet to change the temperature. For example, I was sitting here, and I was running a little late for the show, as you know, so I turned down the air real fast in the house, but unfortunately I turned it down too low, and I didn't want to get up while we were talking, so I pulled up my iPhone, and I changed the temperature in the house with the iPhone. So that's control. Now, you can get more complicated and integrate control and automation together in something more advanced, such as a home theater system. And that would be where perhaps you use a remote control to pause the TV show, so you could, or your movie you're watching, and this, if you're watching the show and the lights are off and you pause is the control portion. You can use, for example, your iPhone or a touchpad or something to pause it. But then maybe you want to automate something as well. For example, you may want to have the lights dim up just a little bit in the room when you pause your show.
Okay.
How easy is something like that to do, though? I mean, down here, the limit of automation in our house is, you know, I think about 6 weeks ago, we decided that we were sick of manually turning the heating up and down at various times of the day, so we finally pulled the book out and worked out how to program the thermostat. So that's how technologically inclined our household is at the moment. But, you know, we don't have the luxury of like a home theater room or something like that. But if you were to do what you just said and, you know, you pause a movie and it brings the lights up in your theater room or something, how easy is that to integrate back into your system?
Mm-hmm. Well, it depends on how you came into the position of having your system. Some companies will come in and they'll install the system for you, and you don't have a lot of control on how that works. If you want to add something, so let's say you start with a thermostat and maybe a security system and some lighting, then later if you want to add support for your home automation system, you would be spending more money. You would be paying these people to come in and perhaps put some dedicated boxes into your system. There's a variety of different packages available to do that, including my own. And the reason I call this a niche product is because if you want to do these things on your own, the ease of installation, to get to your point, is really not where I would like to see it in the marketplace. You really need to know a little bit about, for most of the products anyway, you really need to be a little bit technical or at least a little bit mechanically or electrically inclined, if that makes any sense. So
I understand the concepts. It's more so if you wanted to bring down your lights, would that be, say, something that you'd drive from your media center PC, or is it, or would you have, say, an infrared receiver that would tie in with your Harmony remote that knew that when you were playing a movie, if it saw a pause command, that then it brings the lights back up, or is it at a different level again?
It depends, and I'll just put my own plug in, I guess, at this point. Because
there you go.
The product I produce is at codecoretechnologies.com. That's codecoretechnologies.com. The product name is called ELV. And to give you a little background, when I started with this, I had some of the same questions you're asking. I did find there were some products out there. The products that I was interested in were products that would be run off of, for example, a home server. Yep. And there's a few of them out there. So there's a variety of things to choose from based on your needs and what you want to pay for. I picked a couple of them, and I was interested in a couple different technologies that were not readily available at the time within the software packages. And so what I ended up finding was they would do a lot of what I wanted, but they were not easy to use. They were actually, coming from the software perspective and being a software developer on a daily basis, I felt that the products that I was using were too difficult to use for something that could have been made a lot easier. And that's kind of where I came in and said, I'm going to produce a product that can do all these things, but is at least one level easier to use. And I'm just seeing Gordon's video here. And so to get more to your point, how easy it is it to integrate that, a lot of that has to do with the products that you've chosen and whether or not those products integrate well. And so what you'll find is if you're more of a do-it-yourselfer and you go and buy a particular brand of home theater products and you go and buy a particular type of remote and then you buy a particular brand of light switches, those are all usually from a different company. Now, there are solutions out there that the integrators will come in and they'll put together a prepackaged solution that contains products all from one vendor. Those are usually quite expensive. The do-it-yourself stuff or the in-between is usually much more affordable. So how easy is it to integrate those things? It depends on the software package you buy. ELV is the easiest to use, and I think that there's quite a few testimonials out there that you'll find that will indicate that is the case in our particular domain. So the way ELV works is, and that's ELVE when I say that, the way ELV works is there's actually something very similar to when you go into Outlook and you set up rules in Outlook. When an email comes in from this person, I want it to go into this folder or I want it to show a message. I designed an interface that looks very much like that because I thought it was fairly intuitive. Not only does it show English grammar where you can actually see in English what you're trying to do, you can drag and click. You don't have to be a programmer. You don't have to type for 90% of what you want to do. Now, if you want to do something very advanced, there is a scripting language that's in there as well. That you can use. So there is a point-and-click interface, at least in my product, that allows you to do that. Some of the other products have similar solutions, but they're, in my opinion, much more difficult, especially in that arena.
Yeah, and I think from my perspective, that's one of the things that's always put me off. Even though I'm a techie guy, I like to think that if I'm going to do something like this, it's got to be not just me that can drive it. It needs to be an interface that, you know, my wife can just walk up to it and go click, 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 and it's done.
Sure.
You know, as opposed to having to get under the covers and, you know, delve around in code to make a light turn off and on at a given time of the day or something like that.
Sure. And when I modeled ELV or architected ELV, I decided, where is the current state of technology? Where is the difficulty level? What's the next level up from that? And then I said, what is the next level up from that? So right now, I would say that ELV is one level up from many of the competitors, but I would like to be at that next level where the abstraction, there's more abstraction there. You don't have to get into even as many details as you would today to do. And something that maybe your wife could come in and set up a little easier. Now, your wife could certainly use the product once it's set up, but you're saying, could my wife come in and say, I want to change how this works? Normally when I hit this button, I want the lights to go to 50%, but I want to change that now. So not only do the lights change to go to 70%, I also want to turn on a light in another room.
Yep.
Yeah. And that's kind of the tough part right now in the automation world is there is such a large number of options. There's so many things you can do. There's so many different vendors on the market and devices that you, in order to do something like that, you really need to narrow down the scope of what you're presenting to the user.
Yeah, so I think also from my understanding is there's no standard protocol for devices talking to each other. Is that right? So, you know,
there are actually a couple, but how widely used they are is a good question. And they're fairly difficult. That some of them can be difficult to use. I mean, one example that's just caught on in the last few years is you guys were talking about game consoles earlier, and media centers and so forth. And you started to see the collaboration between these products. I don't know if you remember, like 5 years ago or so, it was very difficult to get to play something from your PlayStation from your home computer, and it wasn't real reliable. There are some protocols revolving around that have nothing to do with turning on your lights. But at least in the media center arena, they're starting to collaborate a little more. And unfortunately, what happens even in that arena is that the protocol may be out there and the standardization may be out there. But as you've seen with web browsers over the last 15 years, everybody likes to do things a little bit their own way. And so things start breaking at that point.
Yeah, okay.
So I assume on the back end how I set it up is because one of the places I see home automation working for me would be in monitoring. I don't necessarily – it'd be nice to be able to change temperature in my home and lights and different things like that. I'd like to be able to monitor things, be able to hop into an application or a web page and just be able to see what's going on and see what's on. And also on top of that is do I go with – is it – hosted on a server or a machine that I would have at home, or are there applications out there where it would be hosted in the cloud? So it'd be something I would just link up to, or
okay, yeah, there's actually a couple points you've made there. First is an architectural point where you mentioned the cloud and how you might access this, and where are your controls, and where are all the pieces of the puzzle? So there's, a variety of different ways you can do it. Different vendors will offer different solutions. One solution is that if I kind of step back and I look at light switches and thermostats and alarm systems, for example, in my opinion, and this is a touchy subject in the automation world, and everybody has a different opinion, but in my opinion, you don't want a single point of failure. So if you have a thermostat, you don't want your thermostat to only be driven by your home automation system. You don't want your alarm system to be so tightly integrated in with your home automation system that if something fails, if there's power or whatever it might be, that you don't want the alarm system to fail because the whole system has gone down. So that's one point. That's my opinion, and I have seen countless other people say it the other way, where they rather have one centralized control point, and they want their entire system to be dumb except for their master server, which controls everything. But in my opinion, if that goes down for whatever reason, if you're running it on an operating system and the operating system fails, then you just lost everything. So that's just my opinion. you talk about the cloud and whether or not you can monitor your system. There are products out there that allow you to go to a website, and they will actually connect in with your home, or you can, or they will communicate with your home on a timely basis, and you can see information about your home. With Elve, I actually own myelve.com, which most people don't know about. So that's a little secret if people don't like to type cocoretechnologies.com. You can go to myelve.com. Now, myelve.com is not a product at this point, but it's a future potential product, which is very similar to what you're describing, and we have done work on, but it's not to the point of being released at this time. But there are products out there that allow you to do that. And I think, let's see, a third question you had, you mentioned monitoring. So with monitoring, there's a variety of ways to do that. For example, I can pull up my iPhone, and I can monitor most of the things in my home. I can check to see if I set the alarm. Or when we left, my wife told me she set the alarm, but did she really set the alarm? So so you can check on things like that. I can check to see what lights are left on in the house. You can check to see what the temperature is upstairs, downstairs, or in the basement. Then there's another point to monitoring that you may have been referring to also, which is historical data. I want to go back and look. How did my air conditioner do over the last month? Show me how often it was on. Show me the temperature outside versus the temperature in the house, and show me a graph of that. That's one of the things that we're looking at for the next version of Elve. We're in beta with version 1.2, which is pretty much complete. And the way I like to do things is when things go into beta, I like to start another branch, and I like to start working on the next version, or at least start thinking about it more. And so I've actually done a lot of work on the historical data and analysis, which is pretty much ready for release. But if I release it now, I won't have anything to put in 1.3. So we're going to hold off on that.
That sounds like the Apple model.
right. So. And I don't want to introduce risk into the product.
Yes, of course.
So that's another thing to look at, and you bring up an important point. That's definitely one of the main things that people like to see. Another point to that is, Gordon, you're talking about going in and looking at the state of your house or monitoring certain things about your home or maybe an office. Another point is security. Who are you allowing to view this monitoring? Are there certain parts of the monitoring that you want yourself to be able to see, but maybe your daughter should only be able to see things that are happening in her room? Or maybe you don't – this goes along with control too. Maybe you don't want your daughter to be able to turn up the stereo beyond 50%. You know, these are things that you could you can do as well. You can actually, by user, indicate what – portions of the software what portions of the control and automation that they can do and go down to that level of granularity.
And the other questions I have with it is, so if I'm automating all these things or controlling all of these things in my house, and then if it's in a closed network, so it's just on my local network, I feel pretty safe about it. If I open it up to a web page or to a linking to a cloud server or something, with the hacking that happens in the technology space and somebody else getting a hold of that data or that control could wreak some pretty horrible havoc. What are your thoughts on that?
Now, the security is definitely something we take very seriously at Elve. I can't speak too much about the other products on the market about that. I think some of them probably do a better job than others. What we do is, first, you have user-level control. You allow, as I mentioned, you can add users to the system, and you can indicate what different people have access to. And this is done using username and password. So you were referring to a little bit there to authentication and how somebody might hack into your system from the outside world. So that it's username and password-based at this point in time. As you know, I have a lot of experience with other types of authentication mechanisms on a corporate level. As well, those are not currently something that's in the system, but could be easily added. I've had a lot of experience with that. But the other part is encryption. Everything in Elve is encrypted. Everything. You don't have, except for some images. So if somebody wants to get into your system, I suppose, and somehow get into the directory where you have some PNG files, they might be able to change something that shows up on the screen, I suppose. But that can be controlled through other security mechanisms as well. But all your configuration is encrypted. Everything about your usernames is encrypted, and it's encrypted differently on everyone's machine. So just because if you're somehow able to hack into someone's machine, that doesn't mean you would be able to hack into a different person's machine. I won't go into the details on how that's done, but so that's another plus. How somebody would hack into your system from the outside world, or if someone hacked into your system, would really depend on how you configured the system and what you exposed to the outside world. It's my opinion that you probably shouldn't expose more than you would want to use. One thing, for example, that I do is with my alarm system, that's kind of a touchy subject. So, and if someone were able to somehow hack in, and I'm not suggesting that they could, but that would certainly be difficult. But if they could, one of the restrictions I do with that is the interface, which is completely, Elve is completely customizable. You can do anything you want and you can change it. It's extremely flexible. So one of the things I do is you're allowed to set the alarm system from the outside world, but you cannot disarm it. And that, for my needs, that works out well. So if someone were at the house and they knew how to disable the alarm, they should probably do it from the keypad. But I'm not going to allow someone to disable the alarm system from outside of the house using the automation system like from an iPhone or some other way.
That's a good point. I wouldn't have thought of that way. John, it appears, you know, we're all the audience that listens to this show, we're a lot of home server users, and so we're used to this idea of a box with a certain amount of complexity, and we kind of argue all the time about that really the complexity that comes with a home server is more than the average user can typically handle. It's just the idea of bringing a home server in, turning it on, and setting it up to the way for most people it's difficult. It sounds to me that maybe today, in today's world, and I won't lump you into that whole group, or maybe I will, that home automation is still a little more, I mean, it sounds like to me, or it feels like to me, home automation still suffers from that same problem, is that for the average user to get to it, the barrier to entry is still pretty high from a technology perspective. It does require too much technical savvy that the average user is not willing to learn. Now, it sounds like you're trying to get around that or get through that or lower that point of entry by making the software easier, but it's still fairly complex. If knowing what you know for the average user, if they wanted to start something with home automation, if they were thinking of trying a bit of it to start with, what's the easiest thing I could do with home automation that would still be techy enough that it has a cool factor, right? I mean,
sure. Yeah. So as I mentioned earlier, there are products out there that don't have any kind of central point. What Elve does is it integrates roughly 85 devices or device types from different vendors so that they all can communicate to each other through a central point. So to your question, how would you, or what would your entry point be if you were a non-techie coming into the system? As I mentioned, there are a variety of products that are self-contained systems. And I think the most common entry point is either lighting or thermostats. And so that's someone who wants to be able to automate the light switches somehow. So most of the lighting vendors will actually, in the automation arena, will actually produce their own remote control. Now, this may be something that's an app on an iPhone, or it could actually be a handheld remote control. For example, most of the Z-Wave vendors produce a product like this. Smart Homes, Insteon, is arguably entry-level product that has that type of functionality. And those systems are fairly easy to install. But the tricky part is, if you're going to install a light switch, you better know how to install a light switch. That's probably the most technical part about that. Now, you could always have an electrician come in and put your light switches in, and you could do the rest, because those are fairly easy systems to integrate. Now, the same thing with the thermostats. If you know how to replace a thermostat without blowing a fuse, because I just did that a few weeks ago,
nice.
Which is very easy to do. Don't cross the wrong wires.
Right.
then then most of those systems can also be easy to use. It's really when you start getting to the point where you want to integrate these systems together, you want a fully operational home theater system from a central point, such as a tablet. That's where you start getting into most of the complexity. But most of the vendors will have some type of system that allows some sort of remote control that you can use. And most of those are fairly easy to set up.
Okay.
A lot of the time it has to do with holding a button down for 5 seconds on one device and then pushing it on the remote control or something to synchronize them.
You mentioned the standards, and you know, again, we're asking your opinion on this, so I get that. But what's holding home automation back from some kind of standardization, and will it get there? I mean, will the market forces push those together, or is there still not enough market force to really make that happen?
Yeah, that's a very good question. In my opinion, and I think you could probably get 100 different opinions asking 100 different people. But in my opinion, I think the last point you make there is probably the appropriate one. There's just not enough drive or need for these types of systems outside of the enthusiasts out there to do it. The cost is a major factor. This is not something that you're only going to spend a couple $100s on, unless you're doing something very simple. There are very inexpensive systems out there. For example, X10 has been around for many, many, many years. There's a lot of devices that are available for that type of system, and they're fairly inexpensive. One of the factors that you have to look at it, and no matter what system you get, is the reliability. How well is that going to work? And some technologies are more reliable than others. On top of that, you also need to consider the type of environment that those products are going to go into. For example, in my home, I have Z-Wave. Unfortunately, I don't necessarily have the best wireless capability in my home. So Z-Wave, in the end, may not have been the best choice.
Okay.
So these are things you're not going to know until you have them installed and are working with them. So, yeah, right. The standards are a major part of this. Everyone wants to do it their own way. If there is a system that is an all-in-one system, it's usually quite expensive.
Sure. Andrew, you've got these solar panels on your roof outside.
Yeah.
And John, so he's got a full array and it's collecting data. Does your software have the ability to connect to those solar panels and gather that intelligence? Is that something, a plug-in that you offer? Is that certainly solar power is going to get more prevalent, I think, we hope, maybe?
Sure. My neighbor actually just did that, and I was a little concerned about seeing the panels, but they did a very good job, and I really like the work that they did. So the question of whether or not ELV or other products can connect into solar panels is a very good question. I think that, honestly, I'm not sure what type of interface the solar panels are providing at this time. In order to interface with a device, that device has to have some sort of interface you can plug into to collect the data or to control. You can always work around that a little bit. For example, if you're trying to determine how much power is coming from the solar panel, if you have a one main feed that comes in from your solar panel array, you could use certain type of technologies to wrap around the cable to measure the amperage or something like that. Mm. That would be more of a hack. That is, you're not connecting directly to the solar panels.
Right.
I don't know what protocols the solar panels are using.
Okay.
I will say, though, that there are a variety of technologies out there that allow you to determine how much electrical usage you have in your home. They can monitor power spikes and so forth. Brultec is one company. I'm not sure you guys are aware of it. Microsoft Home was trying to do this. Google's tried to do this.
Yep.
Both of them have pulled out of this, which is unfortunate, but they both pulled out over the last few months. Or at
Microsoft
least announced.
Didn't give it very much time. I mean, they jumped on that, gave it a month, and then they were kind of like, we're just kidding.
It's a small market, so... Yeah. You really have to be committed, and a lot of these companies are really in it for the money, of course. So,
Right.
So yeah, it's difficult. So as far I don't know what kind of interface the solar panels have, but I will say that ELV is extendable. I've worked with an online community of a large number of developers who have actually added some great software products or some great device interfaces to ELV and to other products, and they maintain those, and I work with those people to ensure the products are working well, and so that works out well. So it's not to say that someone will come along with something like that, but no, I'm not real familiar with what type of interfaces are available for the solar
Andrew,
panels.
What are you using for your monitoring?
Yeah, so the inverter that our panels connect back to has a Bluetooth card in it, and then I interrogate the Bluetooth using the manufacturer's software, and I've got a third party piece of software that picks it up and sends it out to a website.
And then you can check that from anywhere, right? You can just log into that account. Is that user password protected?
No, it's just public domain.
Just open. You sent me that link in the past.
Yeah, I mean, from my perspective, I'm not really fussed about who knows how much energy we're pulling off the roof. To me, it was a good research tool when we were looking at the size of the system and the like as well.
So how's that been working for you? I mean, those have been up there a while now. You were just on vacation, but how are they been holding up?
Yeah, so far since I think the panels went in end of May, we've so far generated 234 kilowatt hours. So that's around about a month's worth of power.
So a month's worth of power in 2 months?
Yeah, 2.5, 3 months, yeah.
Okay. A third to a half. And you're in winter.
Yeah.
Right,
yeah, we're in winter.
Winter.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and the irony of that is our highest power generation days have been in the last 2 weeks, so right in the middle of winter.
It's just been sunnier, those winter days?
Yeah, we've had a couple of really nice cold and really sunny days, so they're your optimal day. So the panel stays cold, you get your higher light to generate more power, because the warmer the panels become, the less efficient they are.
Oh, wow. Okay, so that's a perfect storm then. Cold day, bright sun.
Yep.
Interesting.
Yep,
yeah, and so do you have any idea then, as you're keeping track of that, your output? Certainly, your meter's never spun backwards for you, right? You've never had a day.
Well, we've just gone to a digital meter last week when we were away. We had a monitoring outage for about 30 minutes where the meter was changed over. So prior to that, we were on an old mass consumption meter, which was the rotary disk. And on a day where we'd generate, say, 6 or 7 kilowatt hours of electricity, you'd actually see the disk moving backwards at the pace that it would normally be going forward.
Okay. All right. That's good.
And that's really the one that you do want to see.
Yeah. Yeah, that's highly motivating.
Absolutely. So now we're on digital. You see a number go up, as opposed to the disk actually moving backwards.
Okay. All right. Well, interesting. I think there's some, you know, John, as we talk through this, it just struck me that Andrew's, you know, your idea of keeping trends in that as we bring all that data into a central system, and if I'm monitoring lights and power and maybe power coming off the roof and, you know, those kinds of things, that may drop into an intelligent OLAP or some kind of, you know, data processing where it says, hey, the light outside is this, the temperature is that, I should probably open the curtains here and turn these lights on. I mean, I think that's the ultimate end goal. We're far away from that. What kind of user base do you guys have from I mean, are you, and you don't have to disclose any numbers, but are you seeing pretty much just enthusiasts at this point? Are you getting anybody out there dabbling in it that maybe shouldn't?
The market is mostly enthusiasts. If anyone tells you otherwise, I'm not sure how far I would go with that. But
sure.
unless you're going with one of these companies that provides an all-in-one solution where you're buying all of their products, and again, those are pricey, relatively speaking. ELV, I don't know. If you mind if I disclose the amount?
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah, sure.
ELV is currently in an introductory price. We have four different versions. The first version is the enthusiast version, which is $99.
Okay.
And that gives most people probably what they need. If they need more than, and that's for residential use. If you want more users, if you want more, if you're going to use it on more than a certain number of touch pads or more control points, then we offer a higher end version for that, which is called Elv Power Enthusiast. And then we also sell individual licenses if you want to increase the number of control points that you have. Some of the systems require you to buy each. If you want to control a certain brand of thermostats, you have to pay more money. If you want to then add on some other things, we don't do that. It's mostly just depending on how much you want to use this and how distributed you want. Elv is a completely network distributed application, so that if you had a vacation home, you could install part of it at your vacation home, and through the network or through the internet, you can actually automate events based on what's happening in different places in the world. You can have an unlimited number of control points or automation points that you want with certain parts of our package. So I think I kind of might have gone off track a little bit there, but I think your original question, I believe, was what type of users are we getting?
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think it's mostly enthusiasts. With the way the market was going 5 years ago, it was a much better time for people in home automation. People were building houses. And when people build houses, that's a great opportunity to upsell them on the features that they may put in their home. So that was a fantastic opportunity. Since then, less people are building homes, and therefore they don't necessarily want to do the retrofit or get into the work. And I'll tell you what, if you're going to build a home automation system from scratch, you're best off going with a wired system. Wired systems will provide you much better reliability than a wireless system, as I'm sure most of you would agree on the show.
Yeah, yeah, sure,
definitely.
So, and sure. It's also more secure, of course. But the point to that is we actually built a home a while back, and we were able to go with more of a wire system. We did go with wireless light switches, but the catch is that wired systems are actually oftentimes more expensive in the home automation world.
Okay. How does the power line, so you had mentioned wireless, wired, and then I've heard of the power line, I've read some on it. Do you use that at all, or how well does that work?
I don't. I have used it. There's several power line technologies out there. Maybe I can just go through three of them. One would be X10. One would be Insteon, which actually uses couples with a wireless protocol as well. And another one is UPB, which is probably, well, I should say arguably the most reliable of those three. Those three technologies can be used for a variety of different uses. They can control your lighting. They can control relays or I/O modules that maybe you would want to control an irrigation system with, and usually thermostats as well.
Okay.
But as far as power line is usually considered to be not as reliable, but I think there's a lot of UPB people out there that would argue with that. And one of the problems you'll see with power line technologies is most people don't realize it, but they have two wires coming into their house on different phases. And those phases aren't really connected together. So you'll have half of your house usually on one phase and the other half on the other phase. Well, that's a disjoint system right there. If you put lights on in one area and then lights on one phase and then some other light switches on another phase, you may not have connectivity or you may not have very good connectivity. So most of these technologies provide some kind of coupling device that you can plug in, usually at this is getting a little technical, but
that's fine.
There's usually a point of convergence at your dryer or any type of 240 volt device or hardware in your house. Now, sure. If you have an electrical dryer or maybe an oven, that's usually where it would be. And so what you do is you plug this device into that outlet, and then you plug your dryer into that. And there's some electronics in there that allow communicating between the two phases. Another problem, complexity maybe I should say, to be more politically correct, with power line systems is interference. Your computers may put out a lot of interference. Your refrigerator can put out a lot of interference. Your home theater system can put out a lot of interference. And I'm kind of interested in some of the technologies that have come out or starting to come out over the last couple of years, which provide video over the power lines. And I'm curious to see how well those systems really work, because I come from this background of knowing the type of difficulties that you can have with sending information over a line that's inherently staticky and polluted with just, well,
yeah, just it's messy. Yeah. Power lines are just messy. Yeah, it sounds horribly convenient, but then when you get right down to it, power has all its own problems.
There is one more problem I should mention. I think this has been mostly resolved, but this is back more in the X10 days. But the way you define, identify each device in your home can make a difference between how your what happens in your neighbor's house too. You could have some overlap there, and if your signal can possibly get to your neighbor's house, I've heard stories where there's been some overlap, and you can actually control what's going on in your neighbor's house.
Kind of hack in over at your neighbor's, right? Turning their lights on. They're like, poltergeist.
Whole new level of hacking.
Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting. Well, John, thanks for taking the time tonight to join us and talk about that. I know that's a passion for you. And I think, you know, I think you suffer the same problems that we do at the home server, in the home server arena, that it still is fairly an enthusiast market, and I know you would like to see that roll more downstream to the general user, and I know from what you said that it would be your desire to really create software that made it easier for the end user. You could almost take out home automation and put Windows Home Server in those same statements, because we struggle. Yeah, we struggle with the exact same thing at times, and we know people need backup, and we know people want some kind of way of sharing their music or having it in one place, or we know they want to record their TV and then come back and watch it later, but all that media setup can be kind of complex and complicated, and it doesn't all work together. I mean, so if you just pull out home automation, put Windows Home Server, or put in today's media devices, you run into that same problem of complexity, but at least you're out there trying to make a difference in the on the software side to make it easier. Again, if folks had questions around this and they listened to the podcast and they wanted to send an email to somebody to ask a question along the lines of home automation, do you have an email that you could give out that they could send something to?
Sure, they can contact me directly at Jay Hughes, that's J-H-U-G-H-E-S, at CodeCoreTechnologies.com. They could also join the forum, the community forum that's there, which we get a lot of questions on there. There's also a contact link on the website that they could send.
Very cool. Any guys on Twitter at all?
No, I've not.
Really? Everybody's on Twitter. I know.
You haven't succumbed to the beast.
Not yet.
Yeah, it'll happen.
Well, you know, that's a whole nother show. Let's not go down that. Let's not go down.
Well, Jim, I appreciate you having me on the show. I'm actually interested to hearing more about your HP experience here over the coming weeks, and I'd actually be very interested in hearing more about the solar panels of Andrew as well.
Yeah. Well, if you go back a couple shows, Home Tech, and I can't remember which one. I guess back in May, Andrew talked quite a bit about his installation. So, pop out there. That'd be probably show 20. I'm going to make up a number, 24, maybe.
Yeah, thereabouts. So, I am getting around to creating a blog entry on how we designed it and monitor it as well.
Yeah. Great. Yeah. Great. And you can follow. I'll be trying to post just about every day. I don't know about tonight. I got two podcasts to do tonight, so I'm not sure I'll get to the blog, but I'll be doing that daily at theaverageguy.tv. And if you have any questions, I didn't say this in the beginning of the show, but of course, if you have questions on stuff, you can contact me here, podcast@theaverageguy.tv. So, John, thanks for coming out tonight. Andrew, great to have you, and for you to sneak away for a few minutes during lunch and jump in and join us. Appreciate you doing it.
All good.
Good to see you. Gordon, thanks for making it happen. I know you probably didn't get as much as the show as you wanted to, but it's great to have one of the fellow or the future podcast listeners right there at the desk to help us out with the podcast. I'll remind folks that if they want to contact me again, podcast@theaverageguy.tv, you can follow the show and all the announcements on what's going on. I usually tweet out an hour before we start the show on Thursdays. Just follow me on Twitter @JayCollison, and everybody's Twitter accounts will be out on the show notes if you'd like to get them. I do have an important reminder that we are going to be switching over the RSS feed for this show in the coming weeks. I don't exactly know when yet, probably shooting for the end of September. For those of you who download the show through iTunes, which is a good number of you, you hopefully shouldn't get any interruption in service. I think I've figured out how to make that work. But if you do come out to the site again, we have a new RSS feed, and we will be updating iTunes with the new RSS link. And Andrew has been good about posting that in the show notes if you want to get that link to it as well. Just watch that. If all of a sudden the show stopped coming, check in with us. We've probably messed up your RSS feed. And we're just trying to move off of Podomatic and get everything onto theaverageguy.tv. One more thing. Join us over on Facebook. Search for The Average Guy Podcast. All right, guys. Thanks for coming out this evening. I appreciate you doing that. John, great having you on the show. We'll be back next Thursday, 7 p.m. Central Time for the Home Tech Podcast. Good night, everybody.